You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
I don't suppose you remember, but about this time last year, I was on a panel in the Pagoda, slightly smaller audience. We were talking about the future of the church. And one of the things we spoke about was the ability of the church to create movements, to create things like Make Poverty History, to make a difference. We spoke about the Warm Welcome initiative and how important that was. We spoke about food banks and the need for them. And we talked about the thing that the church could be now, the thing that the church could be in the future. And one of the things I hinted at was that we had been having some conversations with Gordon Brown about UK poverty, which is why I'm so excited that Gordon agreed to come and speak with us about that today. Greenbelt has always been at the forefront of movement making, of making a difference in the world. Transforming the world for the sake of the gospel has always been what Greenbelt has been about over the last 50 years. And now we have a chance to do something about UK poverty. And Gordon's going to speak a little bit about that now, and then we're going to have some chance for conversation, as much as one can do in a crowd this big. You don't need me to introduce the man. You don't need me to go through his biography. You know he was a Prime Minister and Chancellor of the Exchequer. You probably don't know the exciting things he's been doing since that time, but he might tell you a little bit about some of those. But ladies and gentlemen, a Pagoda welcome for Gordon Brown.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm delighted and I'm privileged to be here. And the first thing I want to do is to congratulate all those associated with the Greenbelt Festival on celebrating 50 years of success. 50 years of achievement. 50 years of bringing people together. 50 years of entering the public arena on the great issues of our time. 50 years in which you've established yourself as one of the great national institutions in our country. I know we've got Glyndebourne. I know we've got Glastonbury. But the other G really does matter, Greenbelt. So thank you very much for what you have achieved. And I think it's your achievements and your success and your hard work and your experience that make me say that let us redouble our efforts to make the next 50 years of Greenbelt as successful, indeed more successful than the last. You know, I started standing for elections about the time Greenbelt was formed. And you can then understand how old I am. By the way, the first public meeting I went to, and this is a very unusual thing for me now, the first public meeting I spoke at, and that was 50 years ago, two people turned up. And one of them was the chairman, and he said he had something better to do. So I was left with only one in my audience. So to have a big audience like that is amazing. You know, 50 years ago, when I first stood as a candidate, I said to my home area where I was the candidate, I said, this area needs a representative of youth and fresh ideas. So what do you think I had to say 50 years later? This area needs a representative of maturity and experience. But you know what Greenbelt does? You combine the freshness of new ideas with the stability that comes from great experience. And that's why you will continue to go from strength to strength. And I want to start also by acknowledging the amazing work done by so many charities, NGOs, and civic and community organizations. The work you do and the service you give and the difference you make is something that makes Britain a community and a society rather than just a marketplace. And everything that you've done over the last few years, which is what I want to talk about in a few minutes, to relieve poverty, is something that would not have happened without the energy of so many people who are here today. You know, you can have idealism without action, and that's just daydreaming. You can have action without idealism, and that is the stuff of which some nightmares are made. It's the combination of idealism and action that our leading charities all the Make Poverty History groups that are still in existence in so many different ways, working domestically and internationally, have achieved. It's that what makes the real difference. And I do want to thank all of you as individuals, because you have made difficult decisions in some cases to help people in need, to serve your community, to work in your church or faith organization to help people who are in difficulty or in distress. And we owe it to you to thank you for the work you do to make this a better society. Now, I'm here today because I believe that we are seeing poverty that is greater than at any time in the last 50 years. I believe, I'm afraid to say, that when I was growing up in a mining town and an industrial town, a textiles industry, which was in decline even then, I saw slum housing that had not been cleared from the Victorian area. We had floods every year, which flooded people's homes and made them homeless and in distress and destitution. We had people having to emigrate because they were losing jobs. And in my school, we had traveling people who attended our school for weeks on end and then disappeared for a year and then came back, but people who were completely in poverty. And I saw poverty and destitution at first hand then. But what we are seeing now is something that I never, never thought I would see again in my lifetime. We are seeing children going to school ill-clad and hungry in the year 2023. We are seeing families having to choose between heating and eating. We're seeing mothers ashamed that they cannot do the best by their kids, even though they are doing everything that they can. We're seeing people having to queue up at food banks after a back-breaking day's work because they don't earn enough money to make ends meet. This is poverty that is degrading, demeaning, dehumanizing, demoralizing, and it's got to end. We've got to do something about it. Four hundred thousand families that don't even have a cooker and therefore can't have hot food. 700,000 children sleeping on the floor or without a bed at night because they can't afford even a basic bed. 1.2 million families that don't have basic carpets or flooring for their homes. 6 million families, according to a recent survey, that don't have at least one of the basic things that a home needs, like chairs or tables in the kitchen. 14 million people officially registered as poor in our country today, and 3.5 million to 4 million of them children at the start of their lives. 19 million people, according to Loughborough University, who don't have the resources for the dignity that every family should have to live a decent life in our community. And we have mental illness on the rise. We have, I'm afraid, suicides on the rise. We have the breakup of families on the rise. We have children in care on the rise. And we have to do something about this. Come to a community like the communities I know in my own area where I live in Scotland. And I tell you this, there is despair in the areas that our leaders fly over in their planes but never visit. There is desolation etched on the faces of people they never see. There is desperation haunting the eyes of men and women that you see every day who know that they're not experiencing leveling up, but the community is suffering and being destroyed. Now, some people may say their motto is, God helps those who help themselves. As far as I can see, for too many people, the motto is, God helps those whom he's already helped, and that's not acceptable. What the motto should be is, God helps all those in need of help. And that's what we've got to do as a society. And that's why I'm here today, to support all of you who are preaching a gospel of discontent about what's wrong, what's unjustified, what needs to change, what's immoral, what's a scourge on our country, what's a stain on our soul, what's a scar on the conscience of this great people in this great country where we should be doing better. And I know that charities are finding it difficult too. Charities are often now as hard-pressed as the people they're trying to serve. Because we saw in the last few days that the amount of donations to charities have halved as the amount of destitution has doubled. And I know people who have given a little to help people who've got nothing, who've now got nothing left to give. And we don't want to get to a situation where great charities at a local and national level have got to give up on feeding the hungry because they've got to concentrate on the starving. We don't want to get to a situation where charities have got to give up on helping the down at heel because they have so much priority now to give to the down and out. We don't want to have charities to give up on helping the badly housed because there's too many homeless people and that takes up all our efforts. And that's why we need a movement of opinion now, a coalition of churches, faith groups, charities, companies, all those who are prepared to join this coalition so that we can say genuinely that we are determined to end poverty in our midst and in our generation. Now, I come to you here not as a practicing politician. You might call me a lapsed politician. Maybe a recovering politician. I'm certainly too old to be a British politician, but when you see Donald Trump and Joe Biden, I'm quite too young to be an American politician. My father was a Church of Scotland minister, as some of you may know, and he used to tell me about a friend of his, because my father said, look, you've got to accept that there are so many different political views in your congregation, and you've got to be accommodating and listen to what everybody has to say, and I hope I took his advice. But he told me of a friend of his, if the party that he was supporting won on the Sunday after the Thursday election, he would indicate by only doing one thing. He would choose the hymn, "Now Thank We All Our God." But if the party lost, he would choose a different hymn. "Dear Lord and Father of Mankind, forgive our foolish ways." And of course, if a third party won, "Oh God works in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform." But you know, politicians have used religion in a way that sometimes is not acceptable. When I was Prime Minister, I read about one of my predecessors, Stanley Baldwin, and he'd been Prime Minister in the 1920s and 30s, almost 100 years ago. And he would be writing his speeches in longhand, and he would then hand them to his secretary, and his secretary would get the speech, and then she'd say this longhand, and then there would be a margin saying, "Refer to AG." And so they referred it to the Attorney General, said, "What's the legal issue here? What's the Prime Minister wanting advice on?" And the Attorney General would invariably come back and say, "No advice, no legal issue," until the secretaries realized, refer to AG, refer to Almighty God. And what Baldwin would do was whenever he was in difficulty, he would invoke God on his side. But of course, it's not for us to invoke God on our side. It is for us to be on God's side. That is the only way to do things in our community. But what Baldwin showed and what other politicians show, I mean, just think of the words. His performance gives failure a bad name. Delusions of adequacy. Lost the art of communication. Not, alas, the gift of speech. And that's only the comments that were made about me by my colleagues. And you have got to, and this is the point I'm making today, we have got to press and challenge our politicians to do more about poverty. I was chairman of the G20 at the time of the worst financial crisis in 2009. And I went to a meeting in Paris with Sarkozy, who was the president of France, with the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel at the time, with Berlusconi, the prime minister of Italy, and with others like the head of the European Central Bank. And people were wondering what was happening in this financial crisis. Everything had gone wrong, and of course, it was a moral crisis, not a financial crisis, because the bankers were taking risks with other people's money and gaining bonuses that they didn't deserve. And in the end, the economy was brought down because the risks that they took were not properly supported. So we had this discussion about what to do and how we could improve things. And I had this idea that the banks were completely undercapitalized and capitalism was running without capital, to be honest. But we had this discussion and nobody really could get to an agreement at that time. And then we had a break. And suddenly we heard Berlusconi, the Prime Minister of Italy, now sadly died, but Berlusconi saying, amateurs, he said, amateurs. And we thought, Berlusconi, businessman, politician, he's got all the answers. So we turned to Berlusconi to get the answers, and he was still saying, amateurs. And what he said was, amateurs, he said, don't they realize we have a press conference in 1 hour, and nobody except me has brought a makeup artist with us. That was his contribution to solving the financial crisis. And then I went to see President Lula in Brazil. And President Lula, of course, expert in what politicians often do, and that's blame shifting. It's not my fault, it's someone else's fault. We've all done a bit of that, I'll be honest. And so Lula says, you know, when I became a young trade union leader, say, and people said, things are going wrong in my country. And I used to say, well, blame the government. And then I became the leading trade unionist, and people said, well, still going wrong. And he said, blame the government. And then I became the leader of the opposition. Things wrong, indeed worse. And I said, blame the government. And then he said, and then I became the government. And people said, things are still going wrong. So what did I say? He said, blame America. And that's what he did. Now, I have learned four lessons in politics I want to communicate with you. And maybe they are four lessons not about politics, they're about public life, and they're about the way we do things. And I want to suggest four things to you that you might want to discuss later. And the first thing I want to say, and I think I hinted it in what I said earlier, is don't be afraid to say that poverty is not just a material issue, it's a moral issue. Don't be afraid to say that faith matters in politics and in public life. Don't be afraid to put your views on the public stage and say what you think based on your values. You know, there was a leadership in Scotland election in Scotland only a few months ago. And at the beginning of the campaign, one candidate said she had no alternative because of her religious convictions that she would follow the edicts of her particular denomination, one of the churches in Scotland. Here she stood, she said she could do no other. But by the end of the campaign, almost every candidate was saying religious arguments have no place in politics. And I think both positions have got to be looked at. Because you cannot abandon your values when you enter the public square. You cannot say that what I believe in and what matters to me, I'm going to forget about because I'm now in some different office. You've got to say that your values continue to matter to you and they're really important. You cannot be something you're not and hope that people will think you're ever authentic. You've got to be what you really are. But I think you've got to say one other thing, and that's really important to us who are trying to change society for the better. That no matter what our arguments are from the point of view of our faith, they've always got to be tested by evidence, by logic, by rational debate, by debate and discussion. And we've also got to be prepared to accept the results of what happens, even if we sometimes lose. So what I'm saying is faith matters in the public square. It doesn't control the public square, but it's a very big part of the public square. And don't be afraid to say that poverty, inequality, injustice are moral issues that have to be addressed. Because let's look at the history. All great social movements that I know of, all great social movements have been built on the most ethical and moral and usually religious foundations. If you look back to our history as a country and the abolition of the slave trade, then clearly everybody knows it was inspired by evangelicals of great religious conviction who knew that slavery was wrong. And you know, today we have human slavery at a level that is completely unacceptable, and we will have to campaign so that the crime of using and trafficking slaves is punished rather than going with impunity at the moment. But go right through to 2005 and make poverty history. I was there in Edinburgh. I saw people, many of you would have been there, I believe, on the mound. And it was churches and faith groups and people of religious conviction who were determined that they would use this one chance that we could make poverty history and we could drop the debt. And as a result of what you did, and you shouldn't underestimate what you did, the debt of 40 countries was wiped out to the tune of 200 billion. Unfortunately, we will have to do it again. And at the same time, we doubled the amount of aid that was going to Africa to deal with famine and to deal with ill health and to deal with illiteracy in the country. So don't let anybody tell you that the great social movements have not been built on the most broad and the most important social foundations. And that's why I say to you, secondly, we should have confidence that our values, the values we're talking about today, we can persuade the British people of their importance. You know, I have to confess that I remain inspired by the texts that I read when I was growing up. I'm inspired when I read Isaiah, undo the heavy burdens and let the oppressed go free. I'm inspired when I read on Amos, let justice roll down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. I'm inspired also, that's Amos, and I'm inspired by Micah that says we've got to do justice and walk humbly in the eyes of the Lord. And when you come to the New Testament, who could not be moved by what is said by the Good Samaritan? There's only 700 words of that in the Bible, but it tells you what you have got to do and your responsibilities to other people. And then you go to probably the four words that are the most important of all, probably the first soundbite in history when you think about it, blessed are the poor. And surely that tells us, if fighting poverty is wrong, then the Bible would be wrong, then Christianity would be wrong, then religion would be wrong, then we have got God wrong, and that is not the case. Because look at every single religion around the world, look at every single faith, and they all have the same message, do to others as you would have them do to you. That is the message of Christianity. But Buddhism, show to others, make sure that others have the happiness that you wish for yourself. Go to Islam, work for others, for your brother in such a way that you would have him work for you. Go to Hinduism. This is the sum of duty. Do not do to others what you would have them do to you. Go to, obviously, Judaism. What is hateful to you is hateful to everyone. Go to Sikhism, and it's exactly the same message, that align yourself with work that will not hurt people but will help people. Every single religious faith is talking about the obligations that we have to each other. And then think of people who are secularists but who believe there are moral values. Some of you have read the story about Albert Camus, who started off as a Christian, who did his thesis actually as a novelist on the early Christian church, who then couldn't understand why there was evil in the world and couldn't explain it, and he was then labeled as an existentialist. But in 1946, after the war, after the carnage, in a world where things had broken down, there was a meeting in Paris of the people who were claimed to be the existentialist movement. And so Jean-Paul Sartre was there, Simone de Beauvoir was there, Albert Camus was there, André Malraux was there, others were there representing this existential strand. And Camus said to them from his experience, didn't we get it all wrong, he said, when we said there was no such thing as moral values? And if we were to admit the truth, then would that not be the beginning of hope? And so I say to you, Christians, people from every other religions, people from every faith, people who are secularists but see the importance of moral values, if we could get together in a coalition to end poverty, just think of what we could achieve by working together. Look at Warm Welcome. Many of you may be here who were involved in Warm Welcome during the winter months. It came from absolutely nothing, inspired by churches and faith groups, opening up church halls, opening up libraries, opening up community centers, 700 in total within a few weeks, that were transforming the prospects for people who no longer could afford to heat their homes and were only able to afford, and perhaps not able to afford, to heat themselves. And they were using the church halls and the libraries. And what they found, warm welcome, and they've done a report on this, and they should be congratulated for what they've done, is that people who came to warm welcome were not just coming because they wanted the warmth of heat, they were coming because they wanted the warmth of friendship. They were lonely, and they were isolated, and warm welcome was a welcoming hand as well as providing heat to them. And that is what people achieved this last winter by working together. Think also then of Trussell Trust, whom I've just met today again, and think of the food banks, 1,200 now under Trussell, 2,600 in this country. And what an amazing job that they do, faced with the challenges of rising heating bills, but also rising food bills. And think of what's happened as a result of that. We've now got food larders, food pantries, community kitchens. We've now not just got food banks, we've got bedding banks, we've got clothes banks, we've got toiletries banks, we've got hygiene banks, we've got children's banks. And that has been as a result of Trussell Trust, which started as a Christian organization wanting to help to change the world. And I just want to tell you about something else that I'm involved in, and it's now a multi-bank. And a multi-bank is not just a food bank, it's a clothes bank, it's a bedding bank, it's a furniture bank, it's a toiletries bank, it's a hygiene bank, all rolled into one, so that we can help the totality of a family when they're in difficulty. And we've rolled this out in Fife, and it's now in Manchester, and it's going to Wales in the next few weeks, then to Birmingham. We've given out, I think, more than 1 million goods over the last year in Fife and many more in other parts of the country. But the importance of this is it's not just an anti-poverty bank, it's an anti-pollution bank. Because we're saying to companies, give us your surplus goods, allow us to repurpose them, get them to families that need them, rather than wastefully destroy them, putting them in landfill or finding that they're just lying around the place of no use at all. And so the multi-bank is based on a very simple idea. Companies have goods that people need, and charities know the people who need them. You don't need a marketplace and consumer prices and charging people. If you have the information that you have goods that are available and you have people who need these goods, then we can strike a blow against poverty, but we can also strike a blow against waste and pollution and the damage that's being done to the environment in our country. And I would ask anybody here to pick up the newspapers that's around explaining how you can start a multi-bank in your own area if that's what you want to do. Not as an alternative to your food bank, not as an alternative to existing great charities, but as a supplement to them if that's what you want to do. But I want companies as well as charities to take the responsibility seriously, because they have a responsibility not just to the environment, which is true, they have a responsibility to the families in the communities in which they are operating as companies. You know, there's a great story told about Henry Ford. Henry Ford became the most successful manufacturer of cars in America. And he decided in the early 1930s to open a factory. And he was opening the factory in Dagenham in Britain. And the mayor of Dagenham thought, well, this guy, Henry Ford, one of the richest men in the world, he's coming to Dagenham. This is a chance for him to give some money to the local community. So he wrote to him. In fact, he telegrammed him and said, would you give us $20,000 so we can build an old people's home in your name as a result of your investment that is coming to Dagenham and to celebrate it happening? $20,000 he asked for? No reply. Then he sent another telegram, asked for $10,000. Would you now give us $10,000? Lowering his expectations. No reply. And then the day of the opening, when Henry Ford was flying across to Britain for the opening of the factory, arrived. And so the mayor just took it in his own hands and said, he just announced, Henry Ford has decided to give us $20,000, and challenged Henry Ford to deny that this was the case. And Ford arrives, not noted, by the way, for his philanthropy or for his generosity. And he arrived, and the story that goes is this, that he said, okay, 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 I will give you the $20,000, but you've got to do one thing. When you open the old people's home, there's got to be a plaque on it. And I want the text of one of the chapters in the Bible on this, St. Matthew chapter 25, verse 35. I want you to put this text on the plaque. I was a stranger, and you took me in. No, Henry Ford's philanthropy was grudging. It was minimal. It was forced on him. But surely, as a society, our companies can now do better than that because of the environmental damage that is caused and because of the need to do something about poverty in our midst. And I want to see corporate philanthropy pushed from the margins to the mainstream. I want to see, for environmental purposes, them having to provide not just profit and loss figures, but impact-weighted accounts on what their impact is on the environment and what their impact is on society, on employment, on practices in their community. And so we want to bring these companies in to this coalition where it's churches, faith groups, community action organisations, charities, companies, all fighting in this new coalition that is desperately needed now, given the state of poverty in our country today. But I want us also to focus on the international. Our neighbour is not just the neighbour next door, and it's not just the neighbour in the next town and the next city or the next county. Our neighbour is people in the next country. Our neighbour is people in the next continent. Our neighbour is people we will never meet, perhaps, who we will never certainly know by name, but who deserve our support, and our obligation is to help all those people in the world who are in need. And I just want to tell you a story that moved me. If you go to Rwanda, and you go to the Holocaust Museum there, the Genocide Museum in Kigali, and you go to the first floor of that museum, it's the Children's Museum commemorating the genocide in Rwanda that took place in 1994. And you will see a picture of a young boy called David. And there will be very sparse details. The picture is of this young child smiling. And the details are David, age 11, ambition to be a doctor, favorite sport, football, favorite hobby, making people laugh. And then two lines, death by mutilation. Last words, the United Nations are coming to save us. And that boy, in his innocence, in his idealism, he believed that when we said we were going to help, that we would honor our promises. He believed that the international community, that it said that it would fight genocide, would produce troops on the ground to make sure that he and his mother, who he was speaking these last words to, would survive. And we broke all our promises. And this is what worries me about what's happening to international aid today. That we have made promises, and yet people are dying through lack of food, even though there is enough food in other parts of the world. People were dying a few months ago through lack of vaccines, even although there were plenty of vaccines in Britain, America, and in the rest of the advanced economies. People are suffering through lack of funds because we are cutting international aid just at the time when there are now 800 million people in poverty, where 1.8 billion people don't even have energy or electricity that can heat their homes and give them power, when 60 countries are facing massive problems with their debts, and when, of course, the budgets of the World Food Programme, the budgets of humanitarian aid, the budgets of the World Bank are not being raised to meet this catastrophe, they're actually being lowered. And I have to say this. In 1997, when I became Chancellor of the Exchequer, we were spending 0.28% of our economies on international aid. 0.28% despite the promise that it would be 0.7%. So over these next 13 years, we raised the amount of aid, but raised the percentage as well at the same time, and therefore it was more in terms of the real value of aid, so that we were on course to 0.7% in 2011 when we left government. But now, over the last few years, what has happened is the aid has been cut. And in 2015, by the way, all members of parliament passed an act making it a statutory obligation that the government would deliver 0.7% of aid to deal with famine, poverty, inequality, illiteracy, and ill health. And of course, most people recognize that the battles today are not between our neighbors and ourselves, but the battles we have to fight and the war that is on is against poverty and squalor and famine and the inequalities that I've just talked about. But the budget is now being cut from 0.7% to 0.5%. But even within that 0.5%, money that is, should be going to international aid is going to the Ministry of Defence, it's going to the Foreign Office, it's not going to international aid, and now much of the international aid budget has been taken up in paying for migration support in the United Kingdom, so as big a proportion of the aid budget is now being spent within Britain as is being spent in the countries that are in desperate need. And I want all of us to recognise that we've gone from 0.28% to 0.7%, and now we're back nearer 0.28% in real terms, and that is completely unacceptable, and we must come together to say that every political party at the next election must recognise that Britain has a moral obligation to these countries to do something about it. You know, hope dies when refugee boats, as we've seen in the last few weeks, capsize at sea and people lose their lives unnecessarily. And hope dies when food convoys can't get through, whether it's Ukraine or Syria or Myanmar or wherever there is famine and need, when food convoys cannot get through to besieged towns that are in desperate need of relieving the poverty and destitution of the citizens. But hope also dies when people make promises and they make pledges and they say that they're going to deliver, and then suddenly you find that promises are no longer promises or pledges and no longer even aspirations, but are being cruelly betrayed. But hope comes alive, I tell you, when first hundreds and then thousands and then tens of thousands and then more than that, people get together to change the world. And hope is what is desperately needed, and that is my fourth point today. We must be agents of hope. We must be ambassadors for a better world. We must be the people who are the advocates of a better, better future. You know, hope is the last thing to go in anybody's life, but it's the most difficult thing to bring back. Hope is not just optimism, which is that things might happen. Hope is not just wishful thinking that things could happen. Hope is not just a wing and a prayer that things can happen. Hope is that things must happen. They can, must, and will happen. And that's what we've got to give people in the years that come ahead. And hope is something that I learn most about from a person I will now mention to you, because I know for you also, he will be one of your heroes. I was very fortunate that I met Nelson Mandela almost immediately after he came out of prison in 1990. And I was able to meet him on many occasions. The first time I met him, by he said, yeah, Mr. Brown, representative of the British Empire. but I met him on many, many occasions. And I visited him in Mozambique, where he was living for a while, and also in South Africa, and he came to visit us in Britain. And I'll tell you two stories, which are really ones that I think you'll like. He came to London to celebrate his 90th birthday. And he wanted to use, typically of Mandela, he wanted to use his birthday not as a celebration of him, but to raise money to deal with what he said was the second mountain he had to climb. The first mountain was ending apartheid, and he did it successfully. He said, the second mountain I want to climb is an end to child poverty, ill health, and illiteracy. And he'd use this dinner to celebrate his 90th birthday to raise money for his charity to do this. And he gifted what is called Mandela's Letter to a Child. And if you look on Wikipedia, you'll see the words of it. It's his advice written from a prison cell in his own handwriting to a child about how they should set out in life. And he said, I will auction this and give it to anybody if we can raise money for the charity. And so there it was in a frame and ready to be auctioned. And suddenly we had all people bidding for it. And it got out of control because all the people there were Hollywood actors, Bill Clinton and his wife, all these kind of people who had lots of money to spend. And so I think Forbes Whitaker was to be the auctioneer, but he got sacked because he couldn't do it properly. And then they started bidding, and it was 300,000, 400,000, 500,000, going like that, 600,000, 700,000. And then suddenly there was only two people left, Oprah Winfrey versus Elton John. Honestly, and they were sitting at the same table, and next to Mandela and me and Gracia Michelle, his wonderful wife. And so it goes to 700,000 Elton, 800,000 Oprah, 900,000 Elton, 1 million Oprah, and then Elton John pulls out. And then Oprah Winfrey's told that she's paying in pounds and not dollars. And she thought, and as you know, then the dollar was, the pound was three times the dollar. So it was very, very expensive. It's now hanging in her school in South Africa. I said to Mandela, why don't you just do a second letter and ask Elton John for 900,000? But we didn't get it. And then there was a concert. So there was a concert for Mandela, and some of you may have been there because he had all the famous artists and performers and everybody else there. And so Mandela was enjoying this, and I was having to explain. I'm the worst person to do this. I was having to explain who these great pop singers were. And it was really funny because, just to give you a personal anecdote, because Gracia, his wonderful wife, was there, and she was telling Mandela, who we all called Madiba by Madiba, she was telling Madiba, you mustn't drink any alcohol tonight. Your health, you've got to worry about your health. And here was Nelson Mandela, 90 years of age, hiding a bottle of champagne from his wife and only drinking it when she was out of the room so that he could have his celebration. And I must say, I was colluding with him in making it possible. So he then goes down, Mandela, great man, he goes down and he meets all the artists, and Amy Winehouse, the late, great, and I'm sadly late, Amy Winehouse, she rushes up to him and says, Mr. Mandela, she said, great to meet you. She said, my husband and you have a great deal in common. And Mandela's sort of floored, and he said, Yeah. She said, both of you have spent a long time in prison. Anyway, Mandela that night told me a story which I've never forgotten. In his prison cell, he was allowed very few items. He was allowed, he wasn't even allowed a copy of the Bible. But he managed to get a facsimile of a painting that, again, look up on Wikipedia, is in the Tate Gallery. And it's called Hope. And it's by an artist called Frederick Watts, who's a British artist at the end of the 19th century. Now look at this painting and you will immediately think, why is it called Hope? Because it's the picture of a young girl who's blindfolded, in other words, blinded, trying to play a harp, sitting on a globe of the world, trying to play a harp with its strings broken. And you think, that's impossible. And you think, desolation, not hope. And then Mantella explains, even in the most hopeless situations, you've got to have hope. Even when things are at their most difficult, you've got to maintain hope with people. Mandela, 27 years in prison, suffering tuberculosis. They tried to execute him, and they would have got away with it, but he was fortunate not to be executed, but saw so many of his friends executed. He could have given up hope. We could have lost the leader that brought Africa freedom from apartheid, but Mandela had hope that one day his cause would succeed. And that's what we need to give people today, hope. Hope because the arc of the moral universe, as Martin Luther King said, is long, but it bends towards justice. Hope because we cooperate out of need, yes, but there is a human need, in my view, to cooperate. Hope because, as the Bible says, there is a balm in Gilead which makes the wounded whole, and we can hope that we can make a difference. Hope because the difference we make in the next few years will change the lives, if we can do it, of so many people. So my message to you today, and this is my final message, is don't ever stop believing that you can make a difference. Don't ever stop believing that we can't change the world. Don't ever stop believing that this world can be a better place because all of us can come together to make it so. Don't ever stop believing that you matter and what you do matters and the difference you make will change the world. So let's end poverty and let's make sure that we do it together. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to take some questions. We're going to take some questions, and Lucy, the lovely Lucy down here, is going to tell us how we're going to do that. Lucy.
I am on. So there's an awful lot of you. There is a lot of you. So be patient with us. We are going to try our best to get round you all. We want questions, not just from inside the tent, but from outside. Yes, even in the trees, I can see you. If you do have a question, if you can try your very best to kind of make it towards the edge of the tent, that would be really helpful. And we will do our very best to get to you. The emphasis is on questions. We want questions, open questions, not statements, not speeches. We want questions. I think I've made that quite clear. And on the back of that, I am just going to hope this works. So, do you want to pop your hands up, stand up, wave as you're able, and we will try and get to you. Do you want to go first, Sophie?
I'm looking for somebody from this side.
How weird was it being with all the other prime ministers at the funeral of the Queen?
We're going to take three questions and then Gordon's going to answer them.
I'm at the back. Is anyone? Yeah, okay, over here, I'm coming. Excuse me.
Which podcast would you go on? The George Osborne, Ed Balls one, or Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart?
One more question. For the first three questions, we're going to take them in threes.
I was just wondering, given all that you've talked about there, and you are a politician, you come from a political background, and it seems the way we look at things have got, I'll say loosely, worse rather than better. In other words, the gap between the rich and the poor has got wider. Where would you start? What would be the first thing? Just supposing you were back in office, what would be one of the things you'd want to change instantly, as it were?
Thank you. So, Gordon, those three questions.
These are all impossible questions. I think I'd start my own podcast rather than doing that. And you know, when it comes to the Queen's funeral, and then the Queen, the King's coronation, all the former prime ministers, of course, were there together. And I was actually at the coronation. This is the coronation rather than the funeral. I was having to go to California to speak at a conference about charity, and I was trying to get to the airport as quickly as possible. And I thought, oh, this will be a chance to meet Prince Harry, because he's trying to get out of town really quickly. And I rushed out of the service, got to the airport in record time, and then found he was already on a plane and had taken an earlier plane to me. It's good to meet Liz Truss sometimes, because she's going around the world now talking about how to create stable economies. I keep saying, I mustn't make this joke in this audience, but I will. I keep saying, with all these notices for parties in Downing Street again, what this government will be remembered for is not its conviction, but its convictions. And I'm afraid that's true. But I do want to answer this this question about what we would do about poverty and about inequality. I mean, let's be honest, inequality would last until doomsday if the current policies are all that confront it. We are becoming a more unequal society, and in particular, it's not just inequality in incomes, but if you look at the figures now, it's the massive inequality in wealth. So inequality in wealth is about twice as severe as inequality in income. And the reason for that is obvious, that income is taxed, and you can get some income from that, but wealth is barely taxed because you've got inheritance tax, which can be avoided by many people. You've got capital gains tax, where there are many devices to avoid it. You've also, of course, got other taxes that try to do something about the inequality in wealth, like stamp duty, but of course are only dependent on whether a house is sold at a particular point in time. So given that the economy is not growing fast, and given therefore that everybody is under pressure, you will have to consider how we can do something to reduce the inequality in this country. Now, when we came in 1997, we did a tax on the privatised utilities to pay for a welfare to work programme, and we created what we called the tax credit system, which was replaced by the universal credit system. And the tax credit system was designed when you had a minimum wage and you weren't subsidising employers, therefore by giving families money when their children were in need, you could actually help alleviate child poverty. And that has been blown to pieces by the way that the universal credit system is working. So perhaps the first thing I would do is have an inquiry and review into universal credit and all the changes that need to be made. You know, you've got all these issues, the two-child tax, the bedroom tax, you've got the benefit cap, you've got the housing benefit limitation, you've got the restriction on people getting benefits for 5 weeks when they go into universal credit. And of course, added to that, you've got the loss of Sure Start, you've got the end of the child trust funds, you've got the end of educational maintenance allowance, all of which were designed to tackle inequality. So I think the first thing that any government's got to do now is to say, look, we are becoming a more divided society. The inequalities that exist are now far greater than they ever were. We raised the top rate of tax to 50p and the Conservative put it down to 45p, and that's an issue that has to be dealt with. But the main thing is you need a strategy that is comprehensive to deal with the inequalities in our midst. And what I say about this coalition, Let's End Poverty, what we've got to say is we've got to review what's happening because people are suffering. You know, if you're a three-child family, 55% of three-child families are now in poverty. And that's old statistics because it's got worse since the official statistics were reported. 77% of families with four children are in poverty in Britain today, and that's something that we have to be able to do something about. So comprehensive review, we've got to look at the inequalities that exist in our society. I'm not here to write a manifesto. My advice to my colleagues who are now running the Labour Party is usually not to take my advice. But we've got to do something. Universal credit has got to be reformed, inequalities have got to be addressed, and we've got to do something about the glaring gap in economic opportunities for people from poor income backgrounds who are being denied the chance to get the full benefits of education because of cuts in education and because of the tuition fee system as it's working in terms of university entry. So all these things have got to be addressed. And I hope, however, that we can unite around a common banner to say, all of us, and I include anybody who wants to be part of this coalition from any party, let's end poverty, let's work together, and let's frame a strategy for doing so. Thank you.
Before we take our next question, I'm going to invite you all to do something. Take out your telephones, take a photograph of Gordon Brown, who's going to stand up for me here, and put it on social media, any social media of your choice, with the hashtag, Let's End Poverty. Don't get me in the picture.
Put Jude on the photo. Jude is at the centre of this, not me. You are the person.
So take his photograph. Let's get it on social media. Hashtag Let's End Poverty. Tonight, between 6 and 7, you can find out a bit more about the movement in the living room, which is over there somewhere, and you can pick up these leaflets about it as well. We want it to be a really broad coalition, really broad. So if you're an organisation and you think you want to be part of it, make sure you come along and tell us about it. But movements start with people. And Greenbelt has always been a place where movements start. I think we've got time for three more questions if you're quick. We have an absolute cut-off time of two. Go.
Hey, good afternoon. At what point in your life did you realise that faith was important to you?
Next question.
Hi. You've spoken about the need for charity, and I totally support what you said, but do we also need to take less? Do we also need to run our businesses and our communities differently?
Thank you. Last question.
What would you do to bridge the divisions within UK? We're quite a divided country and there's quite a lot of people who are against the poor and the working class and think that quite a lot who seem to think that they deserve it. And what would you do?
Thank you.
Right. These are great questions, and I hope I can do justice to them. As far as me, I was brought up, I went to church twice every Sunday. My father was a minister, and I listened to his sermons. He used to speak without notes. And I remembered the pauses as he recollected his thoughts. And then he started to type his sermons, and he would type them. And I could hear his typewriter going at 5 to 11 on a Sunday morning. And the service next door was going to start at 11. So I was very much brought up knowing the text of the Bible and knowing the importance of it. But I'm here not, as I said, as a practicing politician. I'm here as a penitent Christian. We never did enough. We should have done more. We need to do more now. But we need to recognize that things are worse and we've got to make them better as quickly as possible. And that's very much part of the faith that I believe in. And I have written about it. And I do recommend Rowan Williams' book about faith in the public square. And I do understand that there is a resistance on the part of people to talking about their faith and talking about how their values influence what they want to see on the public stage. And I believe we should not be embarrassed about that. We must not be dogmatic. We must not try to enforce our position on other people. We've got to submit to reason and logic and evidence, but there's no reason why we shouldn't talk about the things that matter most to us and the values that matter most. And I believe that the reason that we're all against poverty here is because it is for us a moral issue. It's not simply about material circumstances, but that is bad enough. It's wrong. We are violating people's rights, and it's time to right these wrongs. And that's why I want to campaign on poverty. I'm asked about companies, and I think I've been thinking about this a lot because there's lots of measures where companies announce targets. So they say we're going to plant a billion trees, or we're going to do this, or we're going to do that. And people rightly say, well, this is a form of greenwashing because there's no metrics by which you're going to be judged as to whether you do this or not. So you can make all these grand announcements and then nothing happens. And that's why I've come to the view that you need to legislate so that companies publish their accounts in a form that you and I can understand, which shows how much damage they're doing to the environment, shows what their employment practices are in relation to people in their area, and shows what their social responsibility actually is. And until companies are forced to do it, it will not happen in the way that we want, because some companies will do it in their own way and some companies will do it not at all. Just remember the great crash in 1929. One of the reasons it happened was that nobody published their company accounts in any recognizable form that was uniform. And it was only after 1929 that companies were forced into accounting standards to publish their accounts, so we knew then profit and loss. But why shouldn't we know that Esso, for example, does twice as much damage to the environment as other oil companies? Why shouldn't we know that some food companies are actually polluting in a way that other companies are not? Why shouldn't we know when car companies are big polluters and car companies are trying to do something about electric cars or doing something about getting cars off the road? So if you force companies to publish their accounts in a way that you could see for yourself, you would find, I'm sure, because I've seen people who've done some of these exercises, that certain companies are getting away with murder and other companies are trying their best, although they're not doing good enough. So if we want to solve this corporate responsibility issue, you're not in the end going to solve it by just hoping that companies are going to do the right thing. That you can pressure them, you can demonstrate, and of course, some of them will try to change. But the only way to guarantee that is it's a legal obligation. If you're getting immunity as your company, and you're not held responsible for the company's debts, that's what immunity is about in the way companies are structured, then you've got a social responsibility and you've got to enact it. And so the last point is again about a divided country. We cannot say at the moment that we're all in this together, because nobody thinks that at the moment. People think that there are so many unfairnesses and so much injustice. And I'm not blaming it just on one government. I'm saying we've all got to face up to the fact that this country is not fair to a large number of its citizens who are in desperate need of our support and help. You know, I'm the patron of one charity and I'm the president of another. You know, I have seen things in the last year that I just cannot, I mean, we opened a warehouse in Wigan under a multibank. The day we opened that warehouse, a father walked in with his 16-year-old child. He'd read about it in the newspapers, the 16-year-old teenager. And he pushed the teenager to the social worker. Well, she wasn't a social worker, that was a problem. The person who was there and said, I can't take care of this young man anymore. I can't afford it, I'm going to commit suicide, I would do that. And he just walked out and left his teenage son there. And we had to find a social worker, we had to find the mayor to help and so on and so forth. So the young teenager, who was desolate, who was in tears. But these are the problems that are arising in society. You read a case that's in the newspaper about a 44-year-old woman who was actually an anti-poverty campaigner. And she was put into a homeless accommodation because she'd run out of money. And she was desperately trying to get help to be referred for mental illness, but there was no health service appointments available. And the last straw was that by mistake, a DWP official sent her something saying she'd been overpaid on her benefits and had to see her benefit reduced. And this person, who was aware of all the difficulties of the social security system, who had been through it all as an anti-poverty campaigner, sadly took her life. And this case is reported in the Crown Court as her daughter explains the terrible circumstances. And we need just to know the human misery that is now in our country, because people, no matter how hard they work, no matter how much they try, no matter what they do, they simply cannot at the moment make ends meet. And that is not the mark of a civilized society. And that's why I say all of us together can make a difference. If I go out individually, if you go out individually, we might not be able to do much. But if together we get together, and I'm just a small cog in the wheel of this and want to help, but if we go out together, we can make sure that anybody in this country who looks at the newspapers, who watches the television, will know that poverty is once again an issue, and it's got to be dealt with, and it's got to be addressed, because that is the only way we can rebuild ourselves as a community. So thank you very much for coming today. Thank you for allowing me to speak. Thank you for the privilege of being with you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.